Welcome to Pod Space Nine, the last stop for trash in the Alpha Quadrant. This is a rewatch podcast for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, featuring two veteran viewers and one newbie. My name is Justin, and I'll be your way team commander. Joining me as my science officer, Anna, our acting ensign, Jude, and our visiting xenobiology specialist, our guest star, James. James, welcome to the show.
Nice to see you guys. How's it going?
Going well. Jude, Anna, how you doing?
All right. Staring down the gun of having like four major work projects all like come home to roost at the same time and looking at the prospect of like 60-hour weeks until the end of April. So I have that going for me.
I just got out of moratorium, so I don't care about anything right now. It's all chaotic, and I have completely disengaged my shits engine on this one. I'm just floating along.
Also, I would like to say that it's probably amusing that, you know, I'm saying that this episode will air probably around when my like work crunch time ends. So you all can check back in on me when this actually airs.
I love our buffer. It is so, it's so contraindicated by the tone of this podcast that we have such a like an enormous buffer. We should be doing this the night before, but instead we're months in advance, but it actually produces much more chaos than doing it the night before.
Yeah, like the vibes that we record this at like 2 a.m. to make sure that we do it the next day. Like that it comes out the next
but
day.
But 4 months
in reality,
advance.
We do this like months
ahead. I was going to say, because like the last episode that was up, I was like, wait, the jury duty thing, that was ages ago. I remember you telling me about that, Anna.
Yeah. That was in August?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think great. So.
And nothing pleases Aaron quite so much as a topical seasonal reference in our episodes.
Yeah.
Speaking of seasons, how are things in the other hemisphere, James?
Well, first let's for our listeners. James, who are you?
All right. I'm your friendly neighborhood livestock nerd who turned, you know, hey, animals are cool, science is cool, into, oh my God, stats is the first time I've enjoyed math in my life. And through a lot of things that wound up as, it seemed like a good idea at the time, now I do fancy complicated sustainability math for the Australian federal government. So I get to use big data and a bunch of different things to look at how sustainable is livestock production really. And the answer is actually pretty great. I'm from Florida originally, but moved around a bit. And then I worked with a bunch of Aussies during my PhD. One was hiring once I graduated, and I thought, sure, why not? I've now been here five years. And depending on when this comes out, I take the citizenship test in March. So then they're really not getting rid of me.
That's awesome.
Congratulations.
This will probably come out after March. So
a preliminary congratulations on your citizenship test.
Well, I have to, I've taken the practices exam and hopefully, fingers crossed, I got a higher score than some of my Aussie coworkers or friends that took it as a lark. But on the same time, most American citizens would probably not do the best on the U.S. citizenship test.
100%. I would guarantee that most Americans would bomb the crud out of the American citizenship test.
Yeah, I took it for a lark just out of curiosity. I did not do as well as I did back when I had to take it in senior civ in high school. But no, it's good. So yeah, I moved from like Florida to now Australia's Florida, kind of, with much saner politicians, but still a lot, you know, Crocs instead of Gators. And I'm in sunny Brisbane, where it's the relative heat is 103 degrees outside. So thank God for air conditioning.
Meanwhile, it's a balmy 22 here in Ohio.
Yeah, my little sister had her baby last week and the kid was like a week overdue, but it was negative 20 out. And really, you can't blame a kid for wanting to come out in that kind of
weather. Yeah, that's
no, absolutely not.
And she's just over in Nebraska.
Yep, we get frosty here in the Midwest.
Yes, I spent. I should clarify that after we left Florida, I spent like quite a bit of time in Iowa, and I went to Iowa State for undergrad. So I did my time in the cold, and there's a reason I will never live where it gets that cold again, because it had to be negative 40 before Iowa State would cancel classes. At that point, it's warmer on Mars.
And that's the fun number where it doesn't matter whether it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, because it's both the same.
Good price.
Yep. At that point, the buses won't run, and so then they don't expect you to get in. Anything warmer, better just trudge across campus like the most depressing March of the Penguins.
So, James, as a guest on a Star Trek podcast, how did you get into Star Trek?
So I'm a second generation Trekkie in one sense, because my mom was a huge fan of the original series. But I really started watching it in high school and middle school. Unfortunately, I had the shit luck of having really nasty migraines. And with migraines, it takes a while to figure out what meds work for you. And some of it is just growing out of it. So as a teenager, I missed a lot of school and spent that basically lying on the couch, cuddling the dog and watching what was on daytime TV, which, because we did have satellite, was a lot of Star Trek reruns on BBC America. So I was watching Deep Space Nine and TNG, never in order, always like bits and pieces there. Sometimes Voyager Enterprise reruns on the Sci-Fi Channel back when it showed actual sci-fi. I just really got into it and I was very much a fan of it. And then by the time I went to college, I think it was on streaming at that point, or I just pirated it. But then I was able to actually watch things all the way through. But I was just really clicked with Deep Space Nine. But you know, one of the things that got me into biology and science was just thinking about the aliens on Star Trek or in Star Wars or the science fiction I watched and trying to think, like, reverse engineer the biology in my head.
Oh, cool.
That's super cool.
So that's because my training is in like comparative nutrition and biochemistry and physiology. And I just really think, you know, evolution is fucking weird and that's great. And I love how chaotic biology is.
Nice.
That's almost like the reverse way around from like, a way to make a really interesting alien species, like, in, you know, if you're doing world building type stuff where you basically take some sort of like animal on Earth that has like a really strange life cycle or something like that, or something very unique. And you're like, what if alien? And then you then like, you know, backfill to figure out like, okay, well, like if this is some sort of like, you know, if this is an octopus and like it only, you know, reproduces at the very end of its life, what would that look like as an alien? And what would that look like in terms of like the alien society?
Yeah, I can see that.
All right. Well, tonight we are covering, I don't think there are two episodes, like there's been a two episode combo that I've been more excited for, which there's been a lot of like fun combos, but this one is maybe taking the cake here because it's too. So I mean, what is,
like,
they're both horny as fuck. Let's just put that out there, but in very
wildly different
ways.
Yes. Two of the best episodes of this season and two of the best episodes of Deep Space Nine that I've seen so far. So,
yeah,
and it's in a season of
earlier, which,
too.
Yeah,
like, the Wire is my favorite episode of season two. The only one that even comes close for me is Blood Oath.
Yeah,
which is
I think that
one of my, like, I want to rewatch a fun episode of Deep Space Nine. Blood Oath is like one of my two go.
For pure like character introspection, The Wire might be in like the top five of DS9 episodes. Pure.
That doesn't surprise me.
Oh, for sure.
It is one of the best. So tonight we are covering, for the actual episode, we are covering episodes 22 and 23 of season 2, The Wire and Crossover. Jude, we gave you the honor of doing The Wire, so take us away.
The Wire was written by Robert Hewitt Wolfe, God bless, and directed by Kim Friedman. The Wire opens with a scenario we've all experienced. You're doing a flirt, and you accidentally stumble into a disagreement about books or movies, and suddenly things get awkward. Classic early relationship stuff. And Bashir's casual dismissal of what is clearly Garrick's favorite book is kind of the Doctor's trademark foot-and-mouth move. Garrick, however, seems uncharacteristically ill-tempered, snapping about the line in the Replimat, about Federation biases, about the crowd. And when Julia notices his pallor and his pupils, he refuses to let himself be taken to the infirmary, to Julian and a spectating Kira's confusion. You know a Cardassian is acting up when even Kira gives a shit. We pick back up after the compelling and yet skippable theme music.
What do you have against French horns, Jude?
Nothing. I prefer the kazoo, but look, it's just, it's no...
It is like... It's like two minutes. It's
skippable. That's all I'm saying.
It's a great moment to get up and like get yourself that glass of Mountain Dew Baja Blast.
Baja Blast.
Not sponsored. Should be.
Yes, should be.
We pick back up with Bashir tending to another patient, an uncomfortably phallic plant that Dax has recently acquired, which in his professional opinion is sick. With Keiko at a conference for a week, Dax has called in Julian, and you have to wonder how many other people she considered first, for a consult on why. But as he reminds her in his best Bonesian fashion, he's a doctor, not a botanist, Julian ends up doing what any professional does when confronted with a problem. He Googles it. He figures out that they need a fungus and then shares his relationship troubles with Garrick with Dax. Julian admits that even though they've been dating/getting lunch once a week for a year, it doesn't mean Garrick trusts him or he Garrick, or that they are friends, or much more than friends. But it's clear to Dax that he doth protest too much. He somewhat uncomfortably shanks the phallic plant with what is presumably a helpful injections, and then leaves. On his way home, he overhears Garrick and Quark discussing a business deal, and after Garrick leaves, he confronts the lobey little bottom, who claims that it's just to get Garrick a new sizing scanner, and then tries to bribe Bashir with a trip to the holosuite. But Bashir is A, not a top, and B, worried about his boyfriend, so he heads home. The next morning, after tending to Sisko's strained admiral shouting voice and striking out on the deleted Cardassian medical records, being restored by O'Brien, he summoned to Quark's bar to retrieve his boyfriend, who is now hammered. Before he can convince Garrick to go willingly, the Cardassian appears to stroke out. Upon beaming him to the infirmary and doing a scan, they discover Garrick has an implant, an old one. One that not even Odo, as our resident fascist and therefore expert on illegal torture methods, can identify, which leads Bashir to suspect that it's not some obscure Cardassian punishment device. Bashir sicks Odo on Quark for answers, and they arrange to spy on Quark's recent calls to Cardassia Prime, ostensibly in pursuit of whatever merchandise Garrick needs. It turns out he's looking for schematics for a piece of Cardassian biotech that he discovers, to the dismay of his contact, is classified by the Obsidian Order, the Cardassian secret police. Upon returning to the infirmary and discovering Garrick has done a runner, Julian correctly concludes he's gone home and uses his authority as station doctor to barge in. We're just supposed to assume he doesn't have keys to Garrick's quarters, I guess. There, he finally gets some answers. I use this word very loosely. Answers. After dissuading Garrick from taking enough space morphine to kill himself, the device is not a punishment device, but a pleasure device designed to prevent him from being tortured. But it's malfunctioned because he's been constantly triggering it to cope with how much he hates living on DS9. It's been on nonstop for 2 years. We're going to talk about that. Bashir demands that he not give up the ghost, and Garrick finally tells him how he got exiled. That during the occupation, he ordered the destruction of a shuttle carrying both Cardassian civilians and escaping Bajoran prisoners. Unfortunately for him, one of the killed civilians was an important military official's daughter. He is shocked to discover that his sneering, self-loathing confession does not dissuade Bashir, who simply states that he is going to help Garrick one way or the other. Garrick relents and shows him how to turn off the device. Sometime later, as Bashir settles in to help Garrick through the withdrawal, Odo appears and wants to interrogate him about random Obsidian Order cases, assuming he will know about all of them or that he is a suspect. Bashir politely, far more politely than he deserves, tells him to fuck entirely off. He then sits a lonely vigil next to Garrick until he awakes, angry and manic, and in a fury admits the truth, again, the airiest of air quotes, of his disgrace. It was not, as he tried to claim earlier, that he destroyed the escapees. Instead, he let a group of Bajoran children go. He goes into a rage, admitting that his lunches with Bashir were the only part of his life that he looked forward to, before attacking Bashir and falling into a seizure. He's rushed into the infirmary, and Bashir discovers the cause of his failing organs, but worries they won't have time to synthesize a cure in time unless they turn the implant back on. But Garrick, awakening from his seizure, forbids it, and we get another layer of truth. After letting the prisoners go, he tried to cover his tracks and accused his best friend of it, only to discover his best friend had burned him first. He begs Bashir for forgiveness with an air that suggests he is readying himself to die. Bashir, however, is clearly not letting his boyfriend die. He goes and tracks down Garrick's former boss, the head of the Obsidian Order, who is now, air quotes, so many air quotes in this episode, retired, who is all too happy to help, as he wants Garrick to live a long, miserable life in exile on DS9. He also tells Bashir that Elim, the best friend who destroyed Garrick and whom he betrayed, is in fact Garrick's first name.
Da, da, da.
So, yeah. Again, we're going to talk about this. Back on DS9, Bashir is not enjoying a lonely meal at the Replimat when Garrick, back on his feet, asks to join him. He is back to normal, flirty and functional, and refusing to admit that any of the last 10 days happened at all. When Bashir demands to know if any of the things about his past were true, he says that it was all true. Even the lies, Bashir asks. Especially the lies, Garrick assures him, with a grin that says someone is getting lucky. What a fucking episode.
Even the lies, especially the lies.
Yes.
There are three things I want to highlight about this episode. One, it is so horny between Bashir and Garrick.
Oh my God, yeah.
Two.
Yes.
Odo.
Yeah.
What the fuck, Odo? Odo is in the most aggressive, wet fascist mode we have seen him in since like the third episode. And yeah. Three, mm-hmm. the narcotic implant plot is weird and uncomfortable. And I don't hate it, but I don't love it either. But I'm willing to ignore it for the flirting. So the episode gets an A for me. But yeah, those are like the three sort of like plot threads of this episode for me.
Yeah, the like implant thing is sort of just like the MacGuffin that sets up the like social bottle episode.
Yeah.
So from like Robert Hewitt Wolf's own, Robert Hewitt Wolf is like the only, it was like the, so far as I know, like the only Trek, like the only big Trek writer who keeps an active Tumblr.
That's amazing, which, and makes perfect sense given that he wrote this episode,
which is very brave considering what he's done. But he notably has like he's very open about like references or like things that inspired the Cardassians, and one of the things that he talks about that he specifically like talks about as an inspiration for Garrick is his father who served in Vietnam, and how, and that like the idea of the implant not being a drug addiction, but it being about being distanced from the rest of the populace and having to constantly work and find ways to cope when you knew that everybody hated you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah, which I found very interesting. Just like reading that,
Tumblr's like, really good.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to look that up. That's interesting. To his credit, I noted in, I made a mention in my notes the withdrawal scene is pretty well written. Speaking to someone who has done that process a couple times. That manic rage is there, and that read pretty true.
Interesting.
It's a little overplayed, obviously, for dramatic purposes, but that moment of that switch from like I feel like I'm dying to fuck you for trying to help me is a very, very true moment, and I will admit was a bit of an uncomfortable one, but I think it makes it for a very powerful episode that I think a powerful moment in the episode that I can't say whether it played, whether that moment worked as well for everyone as it did for me, but that moment of Bashir sitting there watching Garrick try and pull through this process and then just patiently letting Garak be the mess he is in that moment was very powerful to me.
Piggybacking on that, there's something that also just, one of the things that rung true to me about that is the fact that Garak is a suspicious bastard. He's, as you said, like, he's got a lot of people hating him. He feels, you know, very othered. And given what we learn in this episode about his backstory, you know, he's probably got a lot of issues with letting people get close and vulnerability. And I'm not the first person to say this. This has been covered a lot in fandom and some very good fanfics. But for Garak, regardless of his feelings for Bashir, in his mindset, you could imagine that what's worse than being in love with someone is being in trust with someone. Letting someone see you vulnerable, letting someone get past your boundaries like that to see you vulnerable. Like, as someone who's dealt with some chronic health issues in my life, and I'm not the kind of person who trusts people easily either, it is fucking embarrassing to be seen sick and a mess like that by other people, regardless of what the reason is for, right?
Yeah.
It is very vulnerable, and you can be, you can almost get angry, like, how dare you see me like this? Because you worry, like, you're basically giving someone a knife and trusting them not to stab you in the back with it.
Yeah.
Because when people get sick for whatever reason, they are not, I'll be honest, it's not the same thing. But when I was tapering up a migraine med once in college, I had really bad mood swings. I got that whole like being like honestly really embarrassingly angry about stuff. And it was embarrassing, but just even just the regular kind of like being vulnerable and sick. So for Garak, the fact that he lets Bashir in like that, the fact that Bashir just lets him be like that and sits through it, and the fact that he lets himself be that kind of vulnerable around Bashir. Not that Bashir's really giving him a choice, but to me, that's like the core of their relationship. Whether it's platonic or romantic, I mean, I personally believe that they've been fucking this whole time, but to me, that they can be vulnerable around each other and there's no, he's not waiting for the other shoe to drop when it comes to Bashir. That to me is the core of their relationship as it starts here and as it's developed throughout the series.
Yeah.
It should be noted when I do these summaries, and I treat these two as if they are dating. I have to imagine there are some people listening to these summaries that are like, okay, this bit's getting old. Look, fuck you is my response to that. Because yes. Andrew Robinson gave a great interview. And in our first episode where we talked about Garak and Bashir, he says in the first episode where Garak and Bashir first interact, he's like, I played that scene and every scene after that with Bashir, like, I want to fuck this guy.
Yep.
His words, not mine.
Yep.
So that's the energy he put into that role. And so whether or not...
And Siddig just plays right off of it too.
Yeah. Like
the chemistry that the two of them have is just incredible.
I think one of the things that is that you can... And part of that is just the way they wrote it, but you can, personally for me, I find, especially like the first several years of DS9, I like them like as verbally jousting and flirting, but never sealing the deal.
Yeah,
because that's just for me, the shit I like to read. There's some stuff that goes on later on that I think is a lot more. I like within my personal headcanon of DS9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
During the televised events, they are not a relationship, but personally, I think that afterward, spoiler alert, they both live to survive the series. I think that afterwards, that is when they like actually pick it up. But I think the fun part is you can read into that however you want.
Yeah.
And like, especially like at the start of the episode where they're like walking through the promenade and Julian is just like, oh, I'm so tired. And Garrick's like, oh, entertaining a lady friend.
Yeah. It's such a catty remark. My God.
Mm, yeah.
It's so good.
And then they get on the literature and like, as you said, you know, he's insulting Garrick's favorite book, but then you can just see Garak going, this man has terrible taste in absolutely everything. I love him.
Yeah, you can tell he's like, he's so offended, but he's like, just let it. He's just kind of like, I'm going to keep giving him a chance to say something redeeming. I'm going to keep feeding him a chance to say one good thing. and Bashir just
anything more crushing than like going out with somebody, sharing your favorite book with them, and them saying it was a 6 out of 10. I didn't really feel much.
Yeah, that's why I said it's a moment. It's a moment that literally anyone who's ever been out on dates can relate to, because it's such a relationship moment. It's
and even in just like platonic friendships too. There was a year where I got a friend 3 books that I'd really enjoyed recently for their birthday, and they were like, yeah, all 3 were like bounced DNF, and I'm just like, god damn it.
Yep. my supervisor at my last job, who is a great man, he is a mentor to me, like where I worked for him for 5 years plus. I worked with him during my PhD. I got him a copy of Hogfather for Christmas 1 year. He was like, it was okay.
Oof.
I was, oof. But he's still a great dude. We just definitely have very different tastes in literature.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a decent place to like briefly seg into like the Cardassian literature and the genre that is the repetitive epic.
Yeah, I find it really interesting of like the, I mean, we, there is, you know, there is the state, all art is political, and the, and that doesn't just mean that all art is, you know, like that, like the air quotes good art is, you know, progressive and stuff, but it's also that art is created in, that is, that art can be created with a specific ideology in mind. And the idea of repetitive, selfless, unremarkable service to the state is a genre of literature that is in fact apparently enjoyed. I find very interesting.
Yeah.
Cardassians do not have the bombast of a lot of Terran fascists.
Mm-hmm.
They're a different kind of dictator.
Yeah.
Which is why Gul Dukat is an odd duck among Cardassians. Because that dramatic bitch is not like other Cardassians. Other Cardassians don't have his flair for fucking drama, and not like his.
No. There's the drama, but like you see in Duet or in Profit and Loss, which I know you guys...
Yeah. There is, you know, I think Jude, I think you need to watch more Deep Space Nine, because there are a bunch of Cardassians that have like a flair for the dramatic in various ways. Dukat is particularly like bombastic about it, and like
Cardassians are catty. They're catty and dramatic, but they're not bombast.
Interesting. Okay.
I think that's
the important thing, because we meet, I think, one of the greatest Cardassian catty bitches in this episode. In Gobrin Tain.
And I want to call out very briefly that Tain is played by Paul Dooley, who turns 96 in February and is still an active actor with a shit ton of credits. And
that's awesome.
Maybe most familiar to everybody as Sarge in the Pixar Cars franchise. This dude has an insane IMDb page.
I believe it. He's got that kind of like journeyman actor kind of gravitas.
Yeah. He's in Auburn Tain is... I don't think it's a spoiler to say he'll return.
It would be a tremendous waste if he didn't come back.
It's just one of those things of, you know, it's one of those things of like, they don't make actors like this anymore, where Tain is there for one scene, and in all of that scene he's a character from a Le Carre novel who's brought to life and given neck ridges. He's the retired MI6 spy master.
Yeah.
Who is just instantly started in, and you know, he's air quotes retired.
Yeah.
And he, you know, but still knows what Julian Bashir's favorite tea is.
Julian's face when he offers that tea.
The only time we hear that on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one and only time we hear Julian's middle name.
His face when this guy knows his middle name and his tea order is really good. Like, mm-hmm. Julian is deeply freaked at this moment.
But he keeps his shit together.
Very good.
I'm so proud of him.
Yeah.
It works so well because the first thing we hear about the Obsidian Order is going like, oh, you know, even they're rivals even to the Tal Shiar, right? They're so good. And, you know, if even Odo's going like, okay, you have like, they're spooky, right? And then he follows it up by just proving just how spooky they are and just so affable. And he's like, you know, they didn't give you too much trouble coming through the border. I told them you were coming. Like,
what a power move.
Yeah. Also, could we talk about the fact
that gotta respect game.
Odo is, you can practically see the pseudopod that Odo is sporting as he talks about the Obsidian Order and the Tal Shiar. Fucking Odo is so.
The Obsidian Order didn't recruit him.
He is so wet fascist in this episode. It's wild. It's a real slide back to the old fascist Odo in this episode.
I mean, honestly, it picks right up based off of last episode that he was like, you know, the station was a lot quieter when the Cardassians were in charge.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, it's picking up off of that, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was just kind of...
Yeah.
So there's a difference between, God, I wish I could just punch everyone and there's him reminiscing fondly about being able to violate everyone's civil liberties, to having a peephole, peeper camera in Quark's bar.
I mean, that's just taking your fetish to work.
I mean, yes, you beat me to the joke. Because I'm fairly certain he doesn't use that for work purposes most of the time. But then also coming in and wanting to like interview a man on death's door for crimes simply because he might have worked with an organization. Like, it's just very not good.
I mean, I think it is the side of Odo that doesn't like to leave open cases. But... yeah, no, it's not a good look for him.
And he cannot read the fucking room.
Yeah.
No.
And I'm trying to give Odo a second chance here. He had a good run of episodes. I was trying to give him a second chance here. And
he'll have good episodes in the future, too. It's just there's...
Yeah, yeah. He'll have good
Odo
episodes.
Odo contains multitudes, and one of those multitudes is a wet fascist.
Yes. But this also does set things up nicely with the whole, now there's a bit of cat and mouse between Odo and Garrick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
which...
Can I call for a brief headphones off moment for just a sec?
Yes!
Okay. I am so fucking ready for the Dias cast.
Yes, because it's going to set things up so well for them. Just how that develops from there. And then also, again, like, with Tane showing up again and then, like, Tane playing Garrick against Odo, you get that whole, like... Mm-hmm. God, like the D in Deep Space Nine stands for daddy issues.
Yeah, it's like, come on, guys, just bond over your terrible fathers.
Yes, exactly. And then we get,
and then,
you know,
and then,
to be fair,
and then,
like,
you know, speaking of headphones off, and then Bashir can join you in bonding over the terrible fathers.
Yes. But also, while we've got headphones off, I do say one slightly charitable interpretation of Tane's, like, I want him to live a long life miserably. I think that's him letting him get as paternal as he's allowing himself to get.
Yeah.
I think that is an honest wish. Like, you're not going to survive on Cardassia. At least I'm putting you somewhere where I can still use you later. But also, I do just kind of want you to not die. Like, he's not really paternal per se, but I think that's as close as he gets in the whole series.
Yeah.
And so I love that two part. Just anytime Tane shows up, he has a catty bitch and I love it.
Yeah.
I have to make sure he approved of his son's boyfriend. Really.
I think Jude can probably come back now.
Yeah.
Hello.
But one thing that I love about Tane is that he is one of the few people to ever refer to a Starfleet medical officer by rank.
Yeah.
Oh, that I did notice. That was weird that he kept calling. He called Julian Lieutenant, and I was like,
I think, and it was a very specific, I think it was a very specific thing, because I think it's, despite the fact that he is there as a doctor, he, I think Tane, being a dramatic bitch, is enjoying the idea that a Starfleet officer is coming to him for help.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of like inference there of, you know, the master of the former spy master of the Obsidian Order getting a Starfleet officer in his living room, and he just like he gets to lord it over a little bit. He's, are all Starfleet lieutenants as brash as you are? I don't believe so. And yeah, I mean, like, Bashir is having, I think he's having a little fun with Tane.
Yeah.
Like with Tane there.
Garak has prepared him
because
well.
He's
been leveling up his sneaky bastard.
His verbal sparring with Garak has prepared him extremely well for dealing with Tane. That, like, he's clearly uncomfortable in that scene, but, like, he knows how to, like, not let Tane push his buttons too much and, like, you know, get what he needs out of that scene.
Yeah. Well, for once, he's talking to someone he knows is a spy.
Yeah.
He's been dating someone that might be a spy for the last year. This is swimming in clear waters.
Yeah, he doesn't have to be all duplicitous about that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do love the little bit at the end where Bashir is like, I've got to know, who is Elam? Where is he now? And Tate is like, ah, oh, fuck yeah. Oh, that's good. That's a good one. Fuck. Oh,
that's my boy. Like,
yeah.
He's like, yeah. Elam, I can see that Garak hasn't changed a bit. That man has a rare gift for obfuscation. Elam is Garrick's first name. And you're just like, oh, fuck.
I have no genuine hope of ever finding out for sure what Garrick's backstory is.
Good.
But I'm curious, like, how many versions of it we're going to get over the course of these, what, 7 seasons? Because this has got to be, what, the 4th version that we've gotten?
Plus
plain simple Garak.
Yeah. Also the like, there was the line just a few episodes ago of like, you know, if you're saying that you're, you know, in disgrace and you're also a spy, what if I'm a disgraced spy?
Yeah. I think it's actually funny because I think of this as real after this. I don't think we get any other versions of the backstory.
Yeah,
no. We get additional information and other stories that are told, but this is like, we get our like three, we get the three versions of the story here.
And that's it.
We don't ever get another lie building on these ones. We get additional stories from the past.
In fact, if you check Robert Wolf's Tumblr, someone asks and he says, the truth about why Garak was exiled is fully and accurately explained in The Wire.
That's amazing.
I checked his Tumblr for posts mentioning The Wire, and it's right there in his Tumblr.
That's some king shit right there.
That's some king shit right there. But I like to think of like Elam in the story as like Garrick's training, like what he feels like he's culturally compelled to do versus like what he actually wants to do deep down, and that's like where some of the conflict comes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that it's really fascinating the way that he tells these stories and separates out Elam from himself, like that, you know, and he says himself, you know, it's, you know, which ones are true? All of them, you know, that they're all lies, but they're all true. It's really, really very interesting.
Yeah. What a fucking great line, too. The line at the very end, which ones are lies? Were any of them true? All of them were true, even the lies, especially the lies.
It's one of my, I mean, it might be like, in terms of like, see, like little back and forths, it's maybe my favorite scene in Deep Space Nine. Of just,
for sure.
Because of just what they're doing. And
it's certainly, I think, the best Garrick's been this whole show so far is that exchange. It's
yes,
and I love that he sits. That scene is so good. Bashir is so offended that Garak has just sat down like nothing's happened, And he's just like, are you seriously going to sit here and flirt with me like the last 10 days didn't happen? And Garrick's like, yes, that is exactly what's about to happen.
Yeah. I will be not answering questions at this time.
Yes.
And we told you back in The Passenger to stick a pin in even the X, especially the X.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
James, you have a remark here about Garrick's role as a patriot. And during Profit and Loss, we talked about it a little bit.
Oh, good.
Just the idea of, I mean, Garrick being somebody who is insanely devoted to Cardassia, even if Cardassia doesn't love him back. Which... Yeah.
The Josh Groban recording of Anthem from Chess is Garrick's theme song. That is a hill I will die on.
I'll have to listen to that. I'm not familiar with that one, but I'm
Chess is actually a pretty good musical, and musical about proxy war during the Cold War using chess between Russia and the Soviet Union with spy drama. Mm-hmm. And the song One Night in Bangkok, written by the people from ABBA, is not a combination you'd expect to work as well as it does, but it really does.
Interesting.
It's really, there's like three really good songs, but it's got a really interesting history.
Interesting.
And I don't think there is, I mean, for a character that was created in the 90s, I do not think there is somebody who lives in the, like, I think the literary idea of cold warriors better than Taine and Garrick.
Yeah,
like for two characters who were created after the wall fell,
they really, really do feel like they leapt right out of, you know, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy or something like that. They have really intense spy novel vibes, which are dope. I really love that about the both of them.
There's an episode I can't wait until we get to it.
Oh god. Yeah.
We're so far away from it, but I'm so ready for it.
Okay. Do we have anything else we want to say about this one? Are we ready? I saw your note, James. I just saw it right now about the fact that the Obsidian Order was renamed from the Gray Order so as not to step on on B5's coattails. That is fucking bananas.
I know, right?
Yeah.
That's great. I just think that's fantastic.
I think that's great.
Very funny to me.
Yes. And James, you have a fantastic description of Julian and Garrick that I'd like you to share with the listeners.
Okay, just Julian Bashir, ADHD twink, and his boyfriend, anxiety space lizard with PTSD.
Yep.
They're just such complimentary flavors of neurospicy that I love them to bits. And they're each other's emotional support nerd.
Yeah. I just have one last thing, which is that I want to call out. Two more things. I swear I'll be quick, probably. The first is very, is short because we only see one scene with Sisko in it. And he has a fantastic line that he delivers incredibly well. It was, I wasn't yelling. Yeah. I was expressing my feelings loudly. And the face that Brooks makes when he says loudly just is, I cannot capture it in words. It is incredible.
Avery Brooks is the best face.
My favorite Sisko line the whole season.
I need to capture that as a gif and like just use it as a reaction gif. It's incredible.
I was expressing my feelings loudly.
And the little like split second manic glint in his eyes as he says loudly is so good. And the other thing I wanted to say is that this episode always reminds me a lot of Duet. For obvious reasons of they're both like a bottle episode with two characters who are kind of in a tense, emotional back and forth. But I feel like the two of them are a very nice, like, kind of set of episodes together.
Such weird, different episodes, and yet,
yeah,
a good pairing.
Yeah,
like, yeah. I can't think of two foods that are that I would compare it to. But yes.
So the things that I would the things that I would compare this to is that The Wire is like a nice, it's an old fashioned. It's bitter, but it's good and built on a solid foundation.
But then what's crossover is like what? Adding
crossover
some...
is a white Russian.
No. Crossover is way too fucking wild. Crossover is okay, like putting Baja Blast in your old fashioned.
Guys, crossover. So I wound up going to this bar called Sporty the other night with a friend of mine. And what I ordered was a peach margarita. What I got was something that was like about this much liquid in a like regular small drinks glass that I know there was cranberry juice in it because I saw the dude poured it, but it hit like a goddamn truck. It was like a concentrated Long Island. And I could not tell you what all went into it other than it did not taste like peach or margarita, but got me, but hit like a goddamn freight train. And yet it somehow worked, but I couldn't really tell you what it tasted like other than cool and vaguely fruity.
I don't know. Crossover's pretty fruity.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, but
yeah. Yeah. No, crossover.
I wasn't going for fruity. I was going for, well, that's entirely different and very exciting. And I would order this at a bar that or a drink I once had called a screaming orgasm, which is, anyways,
we should just get into crossover. There's so much to say crossover. About this fucking weird episode.
Story by Peter Allen Fields. Teleplay by Peter Allen Fields and Mike Rapiller, directed by David Livingston. Our episode starts with Bashir and Kira after helping with some medical work on the Bajoran colony in the Gamma Quadrant. The two of them have some personality conflicts over meditation and music, but as they go through the wormhole, their warp field is entirely down and they end up with no DS9 when they reach the other end. They find out that it's in fact orbiting Bajor. They're approached by a Klingon ship? What? And troops beam over. But Klingons show deference when they see Kira and offer to escort her back. The Klingons tell Garak when they arrive that she is an imposter as Bashir and Kira disembark. A voice asks the two of them who they are. Akira in a look that, oh my god, sorry, Zathras is holding a squirt bottle. I have to keep going. Garak, in a much more menacing manner than usual, says that this station, Tarok Nor, is the center of authority for the Alliance in the sector, and calls Bashir a Terran.
Terran.
I refuse to... I'm just going to say Terran. BDSM Kara says that she can't run the risk of letting them go, and has Bashir put to work while taking our Kira. We see that there's a lot of humans, or Terrans in this case, enslaved on the station as workers, as well as a lot of resentment between this version of Kira and Garak, who command the station as its intendant and second-in-command, respectively. Bashir is taken to ore processing, where he finds that O'Brien enslaved as a technician, and Odo is working as an overseer, complete with, like, fashy belts and high collars.
Which I would like to interject briefly in the costuming, which is apparently Renee liked the belt so much that this is why the belt comes into Odo's costume.
That's so funny.
So Jude, Odo's costume gets a belt, like not immediately after this, but like shortly after this.
So what you're saying is he didn't feel like his costume was fascisty enough, so he brought one over from the mirror universe.
Like the high collar,
yeah, it's the high collar that really
the high
does
collar
it.
Is
it makes it look much more militaristic.
Yeah, I mean it's if you want it, you just like you get like high collars. You add rank insignia. You have like blocky rank insignias to the collar if you want it to be super nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That I digress. Kira is taken to the intendant's office, and the intendant asks her if she recognizes the name Kirk. Kira is, in fact, maybe the only person in Star Trek who doesn't recognize James Kirk, which is so funny.
I thought that was great.
I love it, because Mira Kira's like, gosh, I would have thought he was famous.
The intendant explains that a Terran captain named James T. Kirk switched places with the one from Kira's world. he had an effect on a certain goateed Mr. Spock, who rose to power the Terran Empire and reformed it, leaving it suspect to an invasion by a Klingon Cardassian alliance. Kira says that they have to leave, but the intendant says that she can't send them back, and protocol is to dispose people who cross over. Kira appeals to the intendant's vanity, and the intendant has her brought to some quarters. Kira later goes to ore processing and checks in on Julian, who recognizes that, wait, this is the mirror universe. Oh, fuck.
I love that this is just part of, like, their training.
Yeah.
It's just like the mirror universe is just part of, like, Starfleet 302 handling yourself in the mirror universe.
It's, like, super classified and disco, and then they're just like, fuck it. We have to tell them that this is part of Academy training now.
Kira goes to Mirror Quarks, and she tries to get access to a transporter so she can get back. Garak, however, interrupts and reveals Quark has been helping Terrence escape the station. Quark tries to make a break for it, but he's carried away as we see the Mirror Sisko arrive to plunder Quark's liquor stock. Bashir, in ore processing, tries to speak to O'Brien, but this O'Brien is reticent to help Bashir. O'Brien is summoned to Sisko in the bar, who, as it turns out, is a pirate who works for the intendant. Sisko, who calls this version of Miles Smiley, has O'Brien put to work repairing his ship. Sisko is summoned to the intendant's quarters to report on his mission, which is, the air quotes I have here are not like, there is no amount of air quotes that is possible here. When Kira arrives later, we see the intendant mid-bath, and she tells Kira that all the transporters in this universe have been redesigned so that universal travel couldn't happen again. The intendant says that she wants Kira to love her, not fear her.
No, she wants her to fuck her.
Yes.
Let's be really clear. By this point in the episode, it's very clear what the intendant wants, and that's to fuck herself. I'm not saying this because I've got leftover, like, weird horny energy from the last episode.
I'm just trying to get through the summary so we can get to this, goddammit. I mean, listen, we were going to call this episode, like, the most fuckable twink of the Alpha Quadrant, but I thoroughly think that it's just, is it gay if you fuck your twin?
I mean, it might have to be.
Yeah.
Because this is...
twin or clone, really, but yeah.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, gay. Is it gay if you fuck your clone?
Your mustache clone.
The intendant's... Garrick brings Quark, who's made a full confession, and the intendant orders Quark to be killed. When Kira comes back to her quarters, Garak is there. He says the intendant will never let her go. He asks Kira to kill the intendant, and he'll help her get home, impersonating the intendant, and he'll see that she's able to get back, and threatens Bashir if she doesn't cooperate. Kira goes to Bashir and asks him to watch his back, and they have to get back to their ship to escape through the wormhole. Hopefully they can just recreate the accident, I don't know. Kira goes to Sisko to try to get him on her side, but he is very apathetic. Later, at a party the intendant is holding, a Terran tries to stand up to a Klingon, but Sisko has him back down. In ore processing, a containment unit busts, and in the commotion, Bashir steals a phaser. When Mirror Odo tries to draw on him, Bashir shoots him, blasting him into a gooey shower that looks off something off a hentai site.
How much of their CGI budget did that shot take?
Bashir escapes and encounters O'Brien in the Jefferies tubes. He convinces him to help him, but as they're trying to escape, they're captured by the Klingons. The intendant rages, saying that she's through giving the Terrans a soft hand. You know, like slavery was a soft hand. As she orders them away, Sisko pulls a phaser on her, and his crew helps Kira and Bashir escape. Sisko believes he can stir up some trouble over here, and as they get to the runabout, they make their way to the wormhole and are able to come out their original side. The station hails the runabout, but when Sisko asks where they've been, Kira answers, through the looking glass.
So, Jude, welcome to the undiscovered genre of episode, or one of the undiscovered genres of episode. This isn't the
first
last
of
time
all,
that we see the mirror universe. Far
God
from
God bless. Or please God help us. I don't know. What the fuck? What the fuck with this episode? Who sat down and was like, okay, when TOS did the Mirror Universe, Kirk was, but different. It was like they were evil. They were different, but whatever, right? Who sat down and thought that in this Mirror Universe, everything, like, Odo would be the same.
That's just the writer reading the room correctly.
Sisko would just be, I don't know, a pirate? I can't read Sisko at all.
It's like Sisko is like, if you take the manic spark from the moment where he says, I was stating my opinion loudly, and turn it up to 11 and make that like his entire personality.
Yeah.
I think they realize that Avery Brooks just can chew the scenery on like Jeremy Irons levels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they, I would not consider this one. They keep giving him opportunities to chew the scenery like this throughout the series. And every time it is so fucking amazing. Like it's just epic.
Yeah.
It's
so good.
I can't.
Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine the moment where they're sitting around brainstorming for this episode and someone goes, What if Kira wants to fuck herself? And the whole room goes, just slow claps.
Apparently, since the start of TNG, they had been constantly getting pitches to bring back the Mirror Universe. And they were just like, no, we don't want to. Stop. We don't care. It's like, it was a fun one thing. And we don't want to go back there until finally they got to DS9 and they decided to do it with like everything turned around, I guess.
What is worth noting is that, and I had forgotten this, I forgot we never got a TNG Mirror episode because Diane Duane's Mirror Mirror novel is one of my favorite Star Trek books. And I realized that came out the same year as this. I couldn't find the exact date, but that came out the same year.
Fascinating.
And it is nowhere near as horny as this is.
There's also that Mirror Universe TNG comic where like everybody is wearing like sleeveless shirts and like has like the big guns, and that's also, you know,
I was
going
to ask where Guns Out Picard came from, because that's the mirror. Yeah. I always thought there was a TNG mirror, because that's the image of the Mirror Universe I have in this era is Guns Out Picard.
Yeah, I mean, the Diane Duane's Dark Mirror book is really good, and certainly, like, I admit, Evil Troy is really hot.
Yeah, that's the only thing I remember from that book, reading it in
I haven't read 20 it in a while.
or 2000.
Yeah.
I got it on Kindle a while ago. Maybe I should ask her if, like, how much coordination there was with how the Mirror Universe timeline was set up between that and the Deep Space Nine episode. I'd be curious
because from what I remember, they, like, have nothing in common. Like, it's...
No, there's... But other than, like, there seems to be some agreement on how it went from the TOS to this era, there's commonalities in that, but I don't know how much they hammered it out in one.
I do love that Mirror Quark is the ratio of, like, mercantilism to genuinely a good person is reversed.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the 60, the 70-30 mix is switched.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that it's not that he's evil as opposed to being good, which is what you would kind of expect with a lot of these characters. Because that's what I think is wild about this. Because the expectation with the Mirror Universe is that everybody goes from good to evil and evil to good. And that's not what you get in DS9.
Yeah.
Instead, you just get, like, the universe is shitty and everybody's circumstances, and it means that people are like in different circumstances and they behave differently. None of the good guys are genuinely evil except for Kira. Garrick is just Garrick without like a weird ethical breaking point. Odo is just Odo. And everybody else is just, you know, living under our repressive regime.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. The Mirror Universe is always one of those things where, like, if I stop and think about it for more than like 10 seconds, I just go straight to, this makes no damn sense. But like, also it's too fun to care. Like, it's fine. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
And it's such a good conceit though, because in like, especially in the 90s, that was such a big thing in comics. I mean, you got Age of Apocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
And I will say, Dark, so just like Odo and Mirror Odo are not different, that's like how Beast and Dark Beast really aren't all that different either, right? But you had Marvel doing it with Age of Apocalypse. You had, I think DC was doing something similar at the time. So like that whole alternate universe, kind of mirror universe thing was really hot in the 90s in fandom. And so I can see why it was just in the zeitgeist.
Yeah. I see, the last time I watched a Mirror thing was on Disco, and it was not this much fun. Mirror Disco, not as much fun as this one.
I think there's a certain thing to be had with like the novelty of it, and I think the problem with Disco's Mirror Universe is that Discovery's Mirror Universe is not camp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like it's, some of the episodes, some of the better episodes of the Disco Mirror Universe ones are like get more camp, but like by and large, they try to make it make sense, and that's where they fail.
Yeah. It's the Mirror Universe should be a place where there are horny people, where everybody's morals are way fucked up. And that, like, I don't know.
DS9 treats it like a holodeck episode, basically.
Yes.
And, like, that's exactly how I like it.
The only part of the Disco Mirror Universe I genuinely love is Michelle Yeoh, who is having roughly as much fun as
Not a Visitor.
As Not a Visitor is. Mm-hmm. And just foot down on the gas all the way forward. And I will, you know, we have discussed on this show that Disco is nobody on this podcast favorite track. It's got its moments, but I think we would all equally agree, however, that Michelle Yeoh's character is a gift.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
fucking terrific.
Yes.
And truly charming. Does pull off the right Mirror Universe fun, going from like the kind-hearted, you know, sacrificial captain to the evil empress is such a good turn.
Yeah.
That part I love. So, and then the fact that she like conquers Section 31 too is just
yeah.
Anyway,
so, there's a fun behind the scenes thing here, is that Garrick in this episode was not supposed to be Garrick.
Was it supposed to be Gul Dukat?
No, I would give you 1,000 guesses and you would never guess who it is. Worf.
Shut the front door.
Yeah.
He was like, they originally wrote that, like that was the first draft of the script, is that Worf was going to be it. But as it turns out, they're scheduling, like they scheduled, they were shooting this the exact week that this TNG series finale was being shot.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. That would have been dope.
That explains why it's like not in character for even like a mirror version of Garrick.
No, he's just, there's not really the cunning or the brains as much. It's just so out of
character. He's basically just like authoritarian cutout number five.
Yeah.
Played by Andrew Robinson. Replaced
him with like any.
Yeah.
Replaced him with like the any Klingon or Cardassian.
The future appearances of Mirror Garrick are a lot more fun, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Makes me happy that we get more Mirror Garrick. God, I can't wait to see more of Mirror Kira. She's so unhinged.
I love her so much.
I love how like people were like, there was a discussion about the costume and about
her tinfoil crown.
Yeah,
I love it.
Like specifically that, like people on the internet were being like, the costume is revealing, and it's like, no, this is like the same, basically the same like outline as her like usual uniform. I just made it black, and Not a Visitor walked differently.
Yeah.
Well, it's like that Pratchett quote about like how hot someone can look in an extremely buttoned up dark outfit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's at the 80s prom dresses they wear at the end.
Yeah.
I love it so much. I think it's about how awful
she
they
can
are.
Sell it, but she should. That's still a terrible dress.
The fact that Mirror Kira puts her in the same dress she's wearing
is so unhinged.
Yes,
it's so unhinged. I can't.
I'm like, I can't. Mean,
she needs.
It's like I've always wanted to be a twin, and no, also fuck my twin.
Yeah, no, really. That's,
that,
that's
like I said, it is
extreme Fedris energy.
And yes,
like and all the.
Oh God! Oh, Justin, I'm flipping you off affectionately, but I'm flipping you off right. Yeah,
God, it's extreme Fedris energy. I've always wanted to fuck my twin. Well, but you're an only child.
At least Kira didn't like kill her twin and make her twin like her twin into the hilt of a sword and make things even weirder.
Oh, she totally would though.
She would
Thank
though.
Thank you, Connor Goldsmith, for that bit of comics history.
There is literally nothing I would put past Mira Kira. She is. There's just a level of like deranged, like casually deranged to her character. Yes. That is very entertaining, and it's, I'm excited to see more.
One thing that I think is interesting about her is that she is, like, ridiculously evil, but, like, and deranged. But she also, like, has Kira's, like, regular universe Kira at her core, does not like violence. But is where Prime Kira says, I don't like violence, but I'm still willing to use it to...
Yeah.
Stand up for things. Mm-hmm. Mira Kira, like the intendant, is a coward, and this like a coward in not like a I'm too weak way, but I'll do anything else but get my hands dirty myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to do it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't think Kira likes violence, but I also am. I think Kira's lying to herself a little bit. I think Kira's a little more comfortable with violence than she lets on in that. But. Yeah.
I think that like Prime Kira is like comfortable, like or is somebody who
she doesn't like it, like, but she is comfortable with it.
Doesn't like it, but yeah. And is somebody who has been changed by violence.
Yeah.
It's utilitarian violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's violence where it's useful, but she's not going to seek it out.
Yeah. I want to talk about the starting, like, I want to talk about Julian in this episode in general, because we had the first scene. Yeah. I love the scene where Julian and Kira are in the shuttlecraft and he is just being insufferable.
He gets his entire leg from toe to hip down his throat before he is saved by them nearly dying.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just funny because I was like that as a teenager, and I'm so glad I grew out of that. But God, mood is such secondhand embarrassment.
And it dovetailed nicely with the quote from The Wire that we didn't talk about. But there's a quote in there where Derek says to Bashir relatively early in the episode, has nobody told you like how insufferable you are? And Bashir is like, yes. O'Brien, all the time, constantly. I ignore him too. and this is like that again. It's like,
yeah.
It's like, yeah. It feels like he knows he's being annoying, but like can't stop himself, but also like doesn't, it's like, it's not that he doesn't care. It's just like he gets wrapped up in the moment and he like so desperately wants to be like all of these people's friend.
Yeah. Like he, in his brain, you can see it like, look, I looked into all this cool Bajoran stuff because I want to know more about Bajoran culture. I'm trying to be a nice person. And look, oh, it's something we both could like info dump at each other over. But Kira is not the let's info dump at each other flavor of neurospicy. So she's just looking like, I would rather be in a car with anyone else right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and then he gets weird about it. And then it's bad enough that he's managed to like bore her and annoy her. Then he manages to offend her and like make her wildly uncomfortable to the point where she's like thrilled that they are about to die. Like, thank God, a distraction.
Oh, thank God. Saved by the Klingons. Yeah. Oh, and her moment where she's like, please just flirt with Dax. Like, if you try flirting with me, I swear to God, like I'm going to throw you out the airlock.
Julian.
I like my men pathetic and weak, but not that flavor.
No, see, here's the thing. I don't think Kira is. This it raises an interesting question. We've clearly established that Bashir is a bottom.
Have we though? Have we?
I mean, we've talked about
this. I think some people have. I don't prescribe to that. I think that Bashir is maybe not the person to take the lead, but I think he's very switchy. And I think that's
okay.
I think that he I think that he is somebody who's maybe like permissive, but like I don't think he's like, yeah.
He always strikes me as just somebody who's just very flexible, you know?
So here's my question is where I'm going with this. Does the mirror universe also flip you sexually in that regard?
No, absolutely not.
The meme canon is that in the mirror universe, everyone's bi. This was like kind of started as the joke with Mirror Kira, and then Disco just like ran with it. So that's the meme.
Because Kira has some very big like BDSM energy, like top energy in this episode.
Oh yeah.
Some real dom energy
in the main one. She's got top energy in the main universe.
Yeah.
She's like the like tiny fierce fluffy butch.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, like there's a couple span where I was still figuring out the whole gender thing, and like doing the whole very butch to trans dude kind of slow walking thing. But there was for most of grad school, I had Kira's exact haircut.
Nice.
Or at least as close as I could get with my very frizzy hairstyle.
Nice. It's funny how much they like managed to create like a character in that like specific that very specific niche, and I love it.
God bless DS9. Never fails to surprise me how rich DS9 managed to be in that regard without trying. Not even without trying, like accidentally. It begs, like, it's a, I mean, to the point where I wonder sometimes if there's not a chicken egg thing going on here. Like, did DS9 accidentally, you know, create, like, participate in these things? Or did it accidentally inspire?
I think with Mirror Kira, I think what they were trying to do was, I mean, not to get on a thing. I think there is a trope that back when these things were a lot more heavily monitored and enforced, yeah. Like there was basically you could only like the only way you could be like, you know, queer on
would
television
be a villain.
would be as a villain, and like to have that sexuality be a menacing part of it. And I think that,
yeah,
and I think something that you could say is that the mirror universe isn't the mirror universe because everybody's evil, but it takes the parts of, say, what makes Star Trek and makes them more menacing. Where is like, you know, the Federation is, you know, gay post-capitalist society, like, you know, utopia. Well, okay, the mirror universe is evil bisexual menacing.
Yeah.
to which I have to say hello. But
I have mixed feelings on that, because like I love Mirror Kira, and Nana Visitor also clearly like has a ton of fun playing her, which is always a joy. But it's, you know, it does like fit into the like trope of, well, how are we going to show that these folks from the other universe are evil? Well, costume, and also they're gay.
Well, I mean, I think the slavery is a little bit more distressing.
That too. But like, you know, in terms of like the like visual and like character trait coding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of like what they did with the whole like, not that I was very much into Buffy, but like the whole evil Willow thing, mm-hmm, on Buffy, except I think this is a much more successful version of that, or at least version. Like, I think this holds up a lot,
yeah,
better. But yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Anna, do you want to pull the trigger? Anna, do you want to pull the trigger on the thing that made me mad?
Okay. So there is, I find the path from, Mirror Mirror in original series to crossover in DS9. We get some of that history explained as Justin summarized. And I'm never entirely sure how I feel about it. In some senses, it seems realistic, but sitting here in 2023, there's also a portion of the, like, well, we dismantled and reformed a fascist government And the reward of those people was to get like immediately like conquered and subjugated, kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth in terms of like messaging, essentially, that like, oh well, if you dismantle fascism, then like you're gonna get fucked by everybody else, so maybe don't do that.
I don't think we're trying to get a moral thing.
right right. But like,
God, I hope not.
Because here's the thing, the Alpha Quadrant is a very, like, Alpha and Beta Quadrant of the Prime Universe are very dangerous places to live. And the thing that makes the Federation, like, sort of come out on top is that the arc of history just sort of bends to the Federation's will, and they're proven right.
Yeah.
Just through the fact that they just happen to have the best engineers possible, and, like, one or two things happen to go their way. And it's a story, yes, but I think that, you know, in the Mirror Universe, maybe, where a bunch of, you know, where there's this hyper-aggressive society, like, and where it seems like everybody's a little fucked up and, like, horny for blood.
It's like all of the societies are super aggressive.
So, like, Spock apparently, like, just, like, saying, we're gonna just completely disarm is... Okay, not to get, like, Henry Kissinger real politic here, but that's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
And, I mean, sometimes shit sucks, then you get conquered. Yeah. Which is like, you know, maybe don't. You know, the thing that really, like, got me grumbling was, we said a lot of nice things about Robert Hewitt Wolf. Now it's time for me to... put your shit in. It's like Robert, he's like he used the fall of the Roman Empire as an analogy for this. Empires aren't usually brutal unless there's a reason, and that, like, the Roman Empire was as brutal, as nasty as it was, because all around it had very aggressive barbarians that it was afraid of. Now the Roman Empire, and we're talking about the Empire and the preceding Republic, which was an imperialist nation, much like the word imperialism wasn't created yet, but it was based on, it was a constant cycle of the Romans going out and conquering new lands to steal shit from them, and so they could continually bring in capital, land, and slaves into the empire. That is not a sustainable model of growing a government. And the fact that it lasted as long as it did, and you could argue that maybe it didn't last as long as it did. But the answer was that there was a lot of angry people who were just for some reason very grumpy at the Romans for no particular reason. It was no. They built a economically unfair or an economically unstable empire based on pissing off everybody around them, and it worked until it didn't. I don't know. This is my thing of, like, there's a pop history thing of, like, oh, the barbarians came in and sacked Rome and burned it, and it was like, yeah, but there was about 1,000 years of history before that.
Yeah.
And, like, the stuff like the Year of Five Emperors, and just, you know, dude who put his horse on the cabinet. They didn't exactly have some of the best stability people in charge.
Rome failed for a lot of reasons, and it was like Rome was brutal because it had a lot of bad neighbors. No, it was brutal because it conquered a lot of folks so that it could, like, it could engage in a kleptocratic government that was based off raiding other cultures. They just happened to build an empire out of it and genocide. This made me a little grumpy, and I was like, no, that's wrong.
It reminds me of, like, all the various things that we've encountered with, like, the 90s writing, where it's like, ah, it is clear that they did not have Wikipedia.
Yeah. I mean, also, there's, like, I mean, this is, I would say that popular teachings of Rome have definitely changed in the last 25 years. And I think there's a lot, I think it's like that there's a lot of, especially in Star Trek, a lot of pop history that gets written in. But you know, that's just that's how things go.
It's a curse of like so much of modern, modern's not the word, but like so much of pop culture media that right now is that we consume right now comes from the 90s. Like so much of it. And I think, I don't know, I don't want to say like people don't realize, because I think people do realize, but I think a lot of people don't realize, or people are younger, or people forget, because we've lived for, it's been fucking 30 years. People do tend to forget that the 90s, you didn't have Wikipedia.
Yeah.
You had fucking Yahoo. There were 22 categories or whatever they were. They each had like 100 web pages, maybe. And half of them were fucking weird GeoCities homepages that were less reliable than asking your grandpa.
It's like it's Encyclopedia Britannica at the library was like where it was at for, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
for like basic.
Your parents were nerds. You had like the CD-ROM of it.
Yeah, exactly. Like this is exactly how we ended up with horseshit like World of Darkness and Legend of the Five Rings, where a bunch of white kids sit around with Wikipedia, with you know, a world book and Seven Samurai, and come up with a fucking game that is a nightmare of cultural appropriation, or you know, whatever. Like, and these things, these games, these media properties, and they're from all over the place. It's not just role playing games. It's video games. It's movies. It's TV.
D&D. Yeah,
they roll forward, and we're still sort of sorting this out. And a lot of these properties are still there, still rolling this baggage forward. And Star Trek, I think, better than a lot of them, has done a pretty good job of trying to not carry that forward. But it's funny when you run into cases like that, where you find a place where someone's not ignorance, but like it just was your ability to know the things that you might know today just didn't exist. And it's such a wild thing. I'm not trying to drop a dime on anybody. It's just such a wild difference between then and now that has produced some crazy stuff.
That's a change that happened relatively fast too, because like Avatar The Last Airbender came out a decade after this. It came out in 2005. And that's something where they actually deliberately were like, we are looking in this fantasy world that's we're actually like really digging deep and getting experts and doing our research for this.
But also, absolutely.
It came out in 2005. Like, you know, I mean, I was at that point, just it was so much revolutionized. I think even between 2000 and 2005, it just grew exponentially.
Yeah.
Derail this too much, but I think Star Trek has a bad history occasionally of just not checking their shit. All I will say is look at Voyager. I'm going to bring this back to the episode. I want to bring up a thirst item here that is not intended Kira, which is the big Klingon woman bodyguard who Kira has, who I hadn't noticed on previous entries, but like,
God damn.
I have to say that was not not the one that I noticed. The one I noticed was the first bodyguard, the big female Cardassian.
Oh yeah, no, her too. Just both of them. Hello.
I was gonna, my first reaction to seeing her was, where's Quark?
I think that but also the most attractive. I mean, yeah, there's. There's a lot of good eye candy in this episode.
Star Trek in general, but DS9 in particular, loves a woman that can step on you. And I don't know if that's because it's got Quark on it and they're like casting for a very specific audience of one, or what, but I have noticed that, like, and maybe it's those two Klingon sisters from TNG that, like, set a tone and it just kind of went out across the rest of Star Trek. But, like, I have definitely noticed that there is, like, it's a thing in Star Trek. I'm not mad about it. I'm just saying it's a thing.
Yeah. It's
good. It is very much a thing.
I love Brooks, Avery Brooks. He's so good as, like, Mirror Sisko.
Yeah. I love the way that he plays on like the existing character traits in Sisko of the kind of, like, a little, like, manic, bouncy, jokey edge to Sisko that comes out sometimes, like, especially in his interactions with Dax and with Jake. And this is just that all the time. And it's great the way that he's, like, building on something that's already there in the character, just making it a dominant trait.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could also be, like, almost like a glimpse of what we could get out of a Maquis Sisko.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Anna, you actually made a comment on your notes that I really liked about Julian and Kira.
Oh yeah. So this is a fascinating thing. And is it bad that every time I watch this episode, I'm like, maybe this is good. Maybe Julian learned something from this. like I don't want Julian to be, like, you know, temporarily enslaved in the mines, because I don't want anybody to have to be, you know, temporarily enslaved in ore processing or the mines or anything. But also,
comma, but
yeah, Julian, maybe it taught him something. Maybe he can take some of this experience with him and, you know, increase his empathy toward, like, the people of Bajor.
There is, I do think it's genuinely funny that the actor who plays Julian Bashir, not a white man,
yep,
in this show, is absolutely the stand-in for privileged white men. which I have to imagine he appreciated the irony of that while filming. But it is very much like, you do see an episode like this and you're just like, it's not that I want him to suffer,
but it's fun.
But he kind of deserves it. It might be a good character building moment for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like with the whole, back in season one, that whole, like, frontier medicine thing that he put his entire lower body in his mouth in front of Kira.
Yeah.
Or even in this episode, when they're in the minivan, right? that, like, you know, he's there and, like, he's read up on, like, everything with Bajoran music, but he's being a fucking weeb about it, right?
yeah.
A condescending weeb.
Right? Like, he's there, like, yes. He's there going to Japan and, like, mansplaining Japan.
Yeah, it's like if somebody, yeah, he's like, she's thrilled that he's listening to Bajoran music, but then he has to go and have, like, a condescending ass opinion about this Bajoran musician. It's so bad.
But I hope that like, this was an enlightening experience for him.
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say probably not. I feel like Bashir has at least two more seasons of putting his foot in his mouth before we see any significant character growth in that direction, if ever. Don't tell me. No faces, please. But I'm gonna guess that we're going to have to get into the, yes, I know it's coming, Dominion War before Bashir stops being a fucking doofus. I know that much about DS9. I don't know a lot about DS9, but I know there's a war coming.
His quarter life crisis is coming up pretty soon, right?
Yeah, I think that's next season.
It is exactly what you think, Jude.
I cannot emphasize enough how little respect I have for the phrase quarter life crisis. Yeah. So of course he has one.
We've broken an hour and a half here. I am going to, I'm pulling the ripcord here. Okay. James, do you want people to find you on the internet?
Sure. Honestly, I am on Blue Sky at, at Dr. James D on Blue Sky. Some work stuff, mostly me just nerding about stuff in general. Depending on when this airs, I will also be on TV March 2nd Australia time in the Sydney Mardi Gras Parade as one of like 150 people covered in blue glitter marching in the CSIRO parade float, because that's like Australia's version of Pride. And yeah, the federal government science agency has like people competing for slots that we get to march in Pride. So that'll be pretty fun, depending on when this airs.
That's dope.
But yeah, otherwise, yeah. Right. So it's, as someone who used to be in marching band, actually having to march soldier type marching and not the proper marching band walk has been the hardest thing for me to learn during the dance practices. but no, yeah, otherwise, yeah, I'm on Blue Sky, on the Bad Pod Discord.
No, nobody can get access to the Bad Pod Discord. Don't ask. if I had to moderate a Discord, I would nuke the show as retribution. All right. Oh, cool. Next time we're going to be covering episodes 24 and 25 of season 2, The Collaborator and Tribunal. Woo, we're getting some prime Miles O'Brien suffering next time.
Oh yeah.
Are we seriously done with season 2 already?
We will have this, and then we will have the season finale and the one after that.
God.
Until next time. Keep circling. Keep circling. Just keep circling.
Just keep circling.
Yeah.
Just keep circling.
Just keep circling.
The Babylon Project is an independent production. All views expressed on the show are our own. Clips from the original show remain property of the original owner. Music information can be found in the show notes. The rest of the show is licensed under a Creative Commons 4.0 share alike no derivatives license.